Go.
Hello and welcome to Writer Mother Monster. I'm your host, Lara Ehrlich, and tonight's guest is Samantha Silva. Before I introduce Sam, a couple housekeeping notes. Writer Mother Monster conversations are streamed live on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, and then released as an audio podcast on all major platforms. As always, please chat with us during the interview, and we will weave your comments into our conversation. Before I introduce Sam, I have a few exciting updates for you as well. I've just launched the official Writer Mother Monster shop with everything from t-shirts and tea towels to onesies and undies. Support the show in style. And this Mother's Day, May 14th, treat yourself with a writing class with me, your host, and the author of the story collection Animal Wife. We'll share strategies for prioritizing your craft, explore examples set by other writer moms, and do generative writing exercises. You'll leave the workshop energized and armed with a plan for recommitting to your creative work. Finally, a special thanks to our sponsors and patrons listed on the Writer Mother Monster website. Your support helps make the show possible. If you enjoy the episode, please consider becoming a patron or patroness to help keep the podcast going. For details on the store, class, and sponsorship, visit writermothermonster.com. Now I'm excited to introduce Samantha. Samantha Silva is an author, playwright, and screenwriter based in Idaho. She's sold film projects to Paramount, Universal, and New Line Cinema. Mr. Dickens and His Carol, her debut novel, was published by Flatiron Books, followed by Love and Fury, a novel of Mary Wollstonecraft. She wrote and directed her award-winning short script, The Big Burn, which premiered at the Sun Valley Film Festival in 2017. Her work appears in One Story and LitHub.com. Commissioned by Seattle Repertory Theater, she adapted her first novel for the stage. Mr. Dickens and His Carol had its world premiere there in 2022. Sam has three children, ages 26, 22, and 28, and describes writer motherhood in three words as necessity of invention. Now join me in welcoming Sam. Hi.
Hi. Right, thanks for having me.
Thanks for showing up. It's great to see you.
I know. I'm excited to be here.
Yes, me too. So let's start with your three words you use to describe writer motherhood. Those were necessity of invention. Why did you choose those words?
Well, it occurred to me that the saying necessity is the mother of invention, which is, you know, we all know, tried and true, that it just, you know, that we ought to also think, or anyway, I do, that motherhood is also the necessity of invention. What I mean by that is that having an imagination for me was a way to escape motherhood. It was sort of a way to survive it, because as long as I could protect and sustain my own interior life and my own imaginative life, it helped, I think, in some ways make me a better mom, but also make me a more patient mom, because I was, you know, I was feeding the parts of myself that needed nurturing. And so it was really necessary for me, a necessity for me to incorporate invention, you know, in my own life and my own interior life. And you know, it worked. I mean, I was trying to, you know, living in Idaho, trying to make a living at the time as a screenwriter while raising three kids. I had help, but I wanted them to feel like I was there. And, my then husband and I had chosen not to live in Los Angeles and, you know, not to be part of that world and sort of, you know, raise our kids in a somewhat normal environment as opposed to a rarefied Hollywood environment. And so, you know, that part of it felt good, but I was also very isolated. You know, it was very hard. Although my husband was a filmmaker, it was hard to make life as a writer and particularly as a screenwriter living in Idaho. So, you know, necessity really, really, you know, was that I have a life that was filled with invention, sort of as a way to, for myself to thrive and survive all that.
Yeah. Why Idaho?
Well, in a way, partly accidental. I'm sort of a journalism brat. When I grew up, my dad was a journalist, and we moved, you know, for 2 or 3 years from bureau to bureau or magazine to magazine. He worked for Life magazine in its heyday during the 60s. And finally, we were 5 kids, and I think my mother said, speaking of motherhood, you know, my mother said, "I'm not moving these 5 kids anymore. You know, get a regular job." And so we took a corporate public relations job in Idaho, and we moved there when I was 14, and I was, you know, from Chicago, the Chicago area, and I was so mad at them. I don't think I spoke to them for a year. I sat on my little terrace outside my bedroom, and I sat there and, you know, smoked cool cigarettes and didn't speak to them and tore up my sheets and made clothes out of them for a year before I spoke to my parents. So anyway, when I finally left Idaho, after college, I swore I would never come back, and I was gone for 10 years to graduate school in Italy and DC, and I worked in DC and San Francisco, and just happened to come home on my way to Italy where I was gonna, the company I'd worked for folded, and I was, you know, I had $5,000 in the bank, which seemed like so much money to me, and I was gonna, you know, go to Italy and just live in Italy till the money ran out and have affairs with Italian men, which I hadn't done when I was a student there. And I happened to stop in Idaho to see my family on the way to Italy, and my then husband was doing the same thing. He'd been living in London for 10 years, making movies, directing theater, and he was visiting his family in Idaho, and we met and stayed there for, you know, stayed here for 23 years together. I'm still here. He's back in London. But yeah, and it, you know, again, we decided, it was sort of a decision at the time not to raise kids not in LA so much, but in Hollywood. And I know a lot of great families and great kids who did grow up in the business, but I didn't think I knew how to do it. And LA is not a place that particularly suits me, because I think I've, you know, there's so much emphasis on things I don't care about, and youth and beauty. That I always felt too old, you know, and not pretty enough when I was there. And I just thought, God, if I have to raise kids in LA, I will stick my head in the oven. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's fabulous for some people. And I, you know, I still have great friends who live there, but it just wasn't for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I can understand that. Yeah. So is that how you got into writing, through screenwriting?
Yes, I had, you know, again, I wrote a play when I was in fifth grade. I wrote bad poetry. I started a bunch of novels in fifth grade, but then I dropped it. I had other interests, politics, history, boys, you know, all kinds of things. But then when I met my husband, he was already a pretty successful filmmaker, and he was getting, you know, FedExed a lot of scripts every week, more than he could possibly go through. And so I very early on became an informal script reader for him. We had very similar taste. He trusted my taste and my critical eye. And I think, you know, as would be true of anyone, after you've read 4 or 5 terrible screenplays, you think, this doesn't look that hard. Surely I can write a better screenplay than this. Well, as it turns out, it is hard to write a good screenplay. And it, you know, it took me a long time to figure it out. I still consider myself a student of the form. And, you know, and then turning into novelist and playwright, I've had so many iterations of this writing life. But it taught me, you know, it taught me a lot. I learned a lot from Mike, my husband then, about structure and storytelling and plot, and it really, you know, has informed my writing, whether I'm writing for the screen or for the page or for the stage. I'm very driven by what I learned in the early years. You know, very much with him as my mentor in some ways.
Yeah.
He was a terrific storyteller. And then, you know, my father as well, as a journalist, he was, you know, the first and original storyteller, the one I learned from the most.
Wow. Oh, there's so much to unpack there, but let's talk a little bit about being married to somebody who is in a similar sort of industry as you, or if not the same industry, because I don't think we hear that a lot on the show. There are partners who are both writers or who were both writers. So what was that like? And did you feel that there was any competition as you were still learning and writing and selling screenplays?
It's a great question. In fact, I just read a Charlotte Gordon review of a new book. I wish I could remember the title of it, about five literary marriages, including Roald Dahl and Patricia Neal. And it, you know, really, I don't think any of the five she chose were particularly happy marriages. But, you know, the idea was that here were two people who were in their own right, you know, stars in some way, and the difficulties of that. So I would agree that it's a challenging thing. I mean, the great thing about it is that, you know, you have a built-in critique group. And, you know, we were always trading work, and we did trust each other. And it was, you know, very mutually supportive. I think I absolutely became a better writer because of his, you know, his critiques, and I hope he would feel the same. But I would say that there were times when, you know, it did feel that I was a camp follower, that his career was, you know, was more important than mine, was more successful than mine. And, you know, I didn't really want to be in that position, to be the camp follower. And when the kids were little, you know, I loved the opportunity to go with the kids, go to Rome or go to New York, go to London, wherever Mike was making a film. And that was, you know, a marvelous adventure for all of us. But then when they got to be in school age and I was the person, you know, left holding the fort down, I thought, I am not the most likely person for that job. You know, and it's not really what I signed up for, but there I was. And so we had, you know, we had debates and certainly difficulties around that as well. But another thing, that strikes me that happened once is that, you know, I had a new screenplay that I'd finished, and I was showing it to Mike, and I sort of came out and said, you know, so tell me what you think. And he said, you know, I think you have an infantile relationship with your writing. And I was like, what? And he said, well, you know, you go off in your room and you write and write, you come out and you say, look what I made. Do you love me? And, you know, I said, well, I think that's exactly right. That is what I do. But I've never met an artist who doesn't do that. You know, and I think you're the same. And, you know, I'm not sure whether he agreed with me, but, you know, I really felt like, yes, I'm solitary. We're all, you know, whatever kind of art we make, we are off in our room doing it by ourselves. And, you know, when we come out and show it to the world, we are saying, I hope you love what I made, because this is what I am. This is who I am. And it's reflected right here. You know, this is what I have. It's what I can do. So it was certainly a moment in our relationship, but one I'll never forget.
Oh, yes, I think I would have punched my husband if he had said, well, not really, but, you know, no spousal abuse, but I would have been angry, put it that way. Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about that time when your kids are little and your husband is off making films and you're home working. You're raising children, but also working, and you have your own career that you're nurturing. So how did you keep the momentum going during that period when your kids were small and you felt a bit like a camp follower?
Right. Yeah. Well, After I wrote the four or five really terrible screenplays, I wrote the screenplay for Mr. Dickens, what became Mr. Dickens and His Carol. And that's the screenplay that got me an agent. And we, you know, then optioned it over the course of 15 years to four different companies in the US and the UK and Europe, and sort of each time, you know, got very close to the big screen and then would have some heartbreaking near miss, you know, money falls apart, an actor falls out, whatever. And so, but weirdly, you know, I kept making money. It was like the gifts that kept on giving, like as the Carol is for, you know, so many people in the world. But it kept staying alive. And I thought, well, you know, this feels like action. This feels like, you know, something happening. And in the meantime, I was selling other ideas. I was selling pitches. I was, doctoring a few scripts. And, you know, the business was much different then because studios were much more inclined to buy a speculative script. So I could write whatever I wanted to from Idaho and then try to get meetings, you know, in LA, try to sell it. Now what they want, as we all know, is intellectual property, franchises and sequels. And so it's a, you know, the whole structure of the movie business is very different. And I think it's so much harder now, for a writer in Idaho. I mean, you want to be in a writer's room. You want to be where the action is, because you're not going to sell. It's very, very difficult to sell a spec script. So, you know, so there I was, and I never had any shortage of ideas. There was always something that obsessed me that suddenly, you know, was generating enough energy in me that I would start another project. And honestly, those scripts were like lifelines for me as a young mother. I mean, I had friends. I didn't really have a writing peer group here. And that was hard. So I was very isolated, but I did have people I wrote with in different places and people whose taste I trusted. And so, and had an agent, which was big. So, you know, someone that I could use as a sounding board who always read my work, who got me meetings. So, you know, in a way, you can survive on a small amount of action as a mother because there's so much action anyway in your life being a mother. And I think I was sort of getting just enough positive feedback that I felt like, well, you know, keep going. I mean, eventually you'll get a movie made, something will break. And I remember I'd get, you know, my agent would get me meetings in LA and I'd fly down there and I'd go into the meetings and they'd say, oh God, we really love the script you wrote. What else do you have? You know, and I'd be like, but this is what I have, you know, the script. If you like it so much, you know, let's make a deal. Let's talk. But, but they really want to invest, I think, in the writer and, you know, the ideas. If this doesn't fly, maybe you've got 10 other things you're ready to go on. And it just wasn't, you know, it wasn't like that for me. It was sort of serially, I was, you know, I'm a kind of writer monogamist. Like I can only be true to one project at a time. A serial writer monogamist. And I had a similar experience after my marriage broke up. And I had an idea for a TV series that I really thought would be fun to write. And I wrote the pilot and it got some attention, some traction. And a really terrific producer called me and she said, you know, unless you're willing to move to LA next month during pilot season, you should drop this. Then no one will take it seriously. No one will take you seriously. And, you know, my kids were still in high school and, you know, junior high and high school, and I was not going to move my life to LA. And so, you know, honestly, that's kind of the point at which I thought I have to completely redesign my writing career. And what I have is Mr. Dickens. What I have is the screenplay that I've sold, you know, optioned 4 different times. I know the story works. Maybe I should try writing as a novel. And so, you know, it's very similar to sort of thinking it can't be that hard writing a novel. Which I thought about writing a screenplay. And, you know, as you know, it turns out to be quite hard to write a novel. I'm learning how to be a novelist from, you know, going from sort of screenwriting to novel writing was a much bigger leap than I'd anticipated. But it did. I mean, it's, you know, it ended up so happily. I'm much happier being a prose writer than a screenwriter, a novelist.
Let's talk about that transition because that's interesting. So for those, including myself, who don't really know much about the screenwriting side and the whole industry, and I know this is a loaded question, but how are the two industries different? And then how is the craft different? How is writing a screenplay different from writing a novel?
Well, I know that my experience is not the same experience everyone has. And people have nightmare stories about the publishing world. As, you know, we all know them. We read about them. It's a hot topic all the time for writers. But I personally have found the literary world, the book world, much kinder and gentler than the movie world. I think it's filled with people who really love books and really read books and know books and love writers. And I don't think the movie business is like that in the same way. I mean, of course there are people who love, you know, who love the movies, but it's, you know, as they say, they don't call it show art. You know, it's a business. And in the, you know, in the years, I mean, I no longer consider myself a screenwriter. I would, if someone, you know, held my feet to the fire, I would do it. But I really sort of, that feels a bit like my old life. And, you know, I didn't have happy enough experiences. And I also didn't throw all the way in. You know, I didn't move to LA. You know, I didn't give it everything. I gave it something, some part of me, and not everything. And I really did let my husband's career sort of dictate, you know, the path of our life, of our collective life, our joint life. But as a novelist, I've done that completely on my own. I have my own relationships. It's my own world. And I love that. I love that. I mean, our life in the movie business was a big life. And there were a parade of fascinating people always at the dinner table, always coming around, and a lot of travel, and being on film sets is a really thrilling thing. Seeing people with extraordinary imaginations and skills kind of working at the top of their game is a wonderful thing. Watching someone direct a movie is a wonderful thing. But, you know, in the end, I'm an introvert, and I like being in my room with my pages, with my words. I never feel lonely when I'm in the act of writing, because I feel like I can just make up a world. And, you know, these are the people who are my friends and my family. So in fact, when my kids were little, they made fun of me for always talking out loud when I was writing Mr. Dickens. And I think it just became so normal for them that I would be, you know, talking to the computer screen or talking as I'm washing the dishes, you know, hearing a scene in my head. But they just thought Charles Dickens would show up one day, you know, knock at the door and come to dinner. So, you know, for me, I just happen to have had a really lovely experience. I've had I have a wonderful editor, wonderful agent, and they really, you know, they've really looked out for me and supported me, and I feel gratified by that. In terms of the difference in the discipline, it's extraordinary. With a screenplay, you're writing a blueprint for a film that may eventually get made if you win the lottery. And so, you know, you're being as efficient and economical as you possibly can. You can't write interior life in a screenplay. You can't, you know, describe the weather and, you know, and the costumes and the, you know, those are people there's going to be, if you get to set, there will be a production designer and a set dresser and a costumer and, you know, all the, you know, the gaffer and the, you know, all these people who are making your blueprint into a film, and they will have better and bigger imaginations than you have to do it. When you're a novelist, you have all of those jobs. You're in charge of the weather and the costuming and what's on the night table and, you know, what the city looks like and all of the, and I just had never really understood before that, you know, that was the transition I was really trying to make. And it took me a long time to give myself permission to have all those jobs. You know, it's like, it's okay. And with each draft, the feedback I was getting was, you know, deeper, more layers, more texture, more don't be afraid of it. And I think I was afraid of it because I was violating the rules of, you know, the rules of screenwriting. In fact, one of the very first times I went out with it stupidly and burned the read with a really top agent, she wrote me a lovely note back and said, I really wanted to love this, but it felt like notes on a novel. And I think that's because I was still in screenplay world. And, you know, screenplay head, and I hadn't yet really given myself over. It's kind of a, you know, for me, it was a sort of a surrendering to that. And then you have to find the balance. Like how much is too much? I mean, I was a history major in college. I loved the research. I loved the rabbit holes. I could spend, you know, an entire afternoon on, you know, where lace comes, this particular lace this woman is wearing, where it comes from, you know, what the style of the lace is. And how it would feel against her skin. And so I can do that for a long time. But as you know, you have to find just the right delicate balance between all of those things, action, interior life, detail, texture layer. And so I, you know, once I figured it out, I felt like, oh, this is what I love. This is really what I love. I don't want to write any more blueprints. I want to have all the jobs.
I love that comparison and how you describe that transition between essentially submitting to all of these other people in screenwriting and then becoming your own director, gaffer, writer, you know, all those things. That's amazing. So along with that transition, and it sounds like maybe finding what really fulfills you through writing, did that change your relationship with your children, with a partner, with yourself?
Yes, I would say that the big change for me was leaving my marriage after 23 years, and I really, you know, it was the most difficult decision I've ever made, and also probably the most courageous decision I've ever made. But I knew that it would really force me to reinvent my life, as I said, and that I would no longer, you know, the big life that I had with Mike was no longer really available to me. And it was always his big life. And I was, in some way, you know, even though we fought so hard for equality within the marriage, it was never really going to be equal. And, you know, I'm not sure he was willing to surrender as much as I was willing to fight for it. And so leaving that marriage and, you know, knowing, like, having the responsibility for my own big life. Like, if I want a big life, it's going to be my own big life. I'm not going to rely on anyone else. I'm not going to ask for, you know, for help. I want to do it on my own terms. And if it works, that's on me. If it doesn't work, that's on me. But I'm not going to, you know, I'm drawn, you know, particularly, it wasn't just, Dickens wasn't the first, but my own father. And then, you know, and then I married someone like my father who was big, larger than life, charismatic, difficult, complex, brilliant, and a star, you know, in some ways. And I think I knew that I had my own light. And I didn't really want to be, I didn't want to stand in the shadow anymore. And so it's really been, for the last 10 years, the whole process of writing the novel and working on other short fiction, and particularly writing the play for Mr. Dickens, adapting my own novel for the stage, has been all me. And so my children, you know, because of the way I left the marriage, I fell in love with someone else and left for that person. That was a very painful time for everyone. And my kids were teenagers. My oldest son, Atticus, had just turned 18, and we were living in London, and he was going off to Cairo. It was the Arab Spring. And, you know, his parents' marriage was falling apart. He wouldn't speak to, he didn't speak to me for 10 months. Even when we had to sort of spirit him out of the country, when things got dicey there. So, you know, my girls were teenagers, really on the, you know, just in the thick of adolescence. And so I think it's very, it's hard for them to separate the trauma of that time and that moment from, you know, from this transition that I've made. I mean, they now see me as happier, more successful, both, you know, personally and professionally. But it's still tied up with a lot of pain, you know, that we all went through. And that's, you know, that's a really difficult thing about being a mother and having responsibility for people besides yourself, because there are ethical considerations that are so different than when you're a solo traveler. It's like, what is my happiness worth? You know, at what cost? How much harm, you know, will it cause? And, you know, is that a price I'm willing to pay? Or is it better to sort of sublimate my own needs, to, you know, suppress my own desire in order just to keep the family whole? And I know people who've done both. I don't envy anyone that decision. It's the hardest thing I've ever done. But we all have a different answer. And I think my kids, I really believed in my kids. And they've come to understand and be happy for me. And we always say when I ask them, you know, are you ready for me to write about this now? And they're like, Mom, you're a writer. You know, it's your story too. But it turned out when we started to have that conversation, I learned that my son and my daughter were writing an album about the divorce. And I said, well, how many songs do you have? And they said, oh, 14. And then my youngest was taking a creative writing class, and they had to pitch 3 story ideas to their class, and 2 of them were about the divorce. So I figured, well, look, you know, it's everyone's story to tell. And when I'm ready, I'll tell the story too.
Wow, you have a family of writers and creatives. It's just, it would be very interesting someday, and probably challenging for you and your family to see it all together, but to put all of those together and release like a family album / novel / screenplay.
It's a multimedia experience.
There you go.
That's a good idea. They'd be up for that.
Multimedia experience. There you go. Yeah.
But, you know, true confessions about my kids as well is that I don't think any of them have read either of my novels.
I was going to ask you that, really.
Yeah. They'll read shorter things. They'll read, you know, short fiction. My son's read a couple of screenplays. But, yeah, they are not interested. So I don't know. I can't really force them. I just, you know, it's at some point they'll pick it up and think, oh, okay, well, maybe I will read this.
Someday when they're ready.
When they're ready, exactly.
So let's talk about the second novel, because she kind of ties in Mary Wollstonecraft. So, and as a history major, I'm sure, you know, that probably drew you to her as well. So tell us about Mary and what drew you to her and about the novel.
Well, I had a 2-book deal when Mr. Dickens, when we signed on with Flatiron Books, and I really had no idea what the second novel was going to be. And I can remember, you know, I'd worked on Dickens for so many years. I mean, really, you know, I started when my kids were little, and now they were, you know, grown-ups. And so it was very hard, for one thing, to let Dickens go. I mean, it felt like, you know, he really was a part of my soul, part of my family, and it was hard to let him go. But I wanted an idea that would captivate me that much, and I didn't really have anything. And so I'm sitting in my agent's office one day, and she's this lovely English woman, and it was the 200th anniversary of the publication of Frankenstein. And she said, so Mary Shelley was everywhere, you know, just in the zeitgeist. We were all reading Frankenstein again. And she said, what about Mary Wollstonecraft? You know, everyone knows Mary Shelley, but no one really knows her mother. And, you know, I realized in an instant that, oh, my God, yeah, I confused them, too, because Mary Shelley went often, you know, signed as Mary Shelley Wollstonecraft. So I thought, well, God, that's an interesting idea. And when I started to read about her biographies and letters and her own writing, I was really captivated by her. She's considered, you know, by many as the sort of, you know, proto-feminist, the mother of feminism, and lived had a really difficult life. And I think in some ways, although the word feminism didn't exist at the time, she lives from the 1750s to and dies in 1797 when she's 38 years old. She dies giving birth 10 days after she gives birth to Mary Shelley. So I realize that, you know, feminism doesn't exist yet as an idea or as a word, but she's inventing the life. And in that way, she was completely captivating to me. I mean, she's bucking all the norms, you know, demanding things for herself and for other women that is, you know, are just, they're brave things to ask for and expect of a society that's so patriarchal as ours still is. So anyway, I really just felt so compelled by her. But I didn't know with Mr. Dickens, I was working with a 6-week moment in his life when he's writing A Christmas Carol. And with Wollstonecraft, it was like, how do I encapsulate an entire life? And I had no idea how to create structure and plot out of that, out of someone's life. And so I actually put butcher block paper up against, you know, a long wall in my living room for weeks and weeks and weeks. And as I read, I just would put, you know, multicolored post-it notes that I'd write something on them and stick them on the butcher block paper, like looking for a frame or a structure or narrative arc to her life. And then, you know, I remembered sort of I thought about my obsession with this idea that she gives birth to Mary Shelley. And in the beginning, the first 5 days, they think the baby will die because she's born weak and low and doesn't nurse. And then Mary's placenta doesn't deliver. And so a doctor comes, doesn't wash his hands, and sticks a dirty hand in her womb to pull out the placenta. And she develops puerperal fever and dies 5 days later. So, you know, it was like this sort of 10-day period of Mary Shelley and Mary Wollstonecraft, you know, two of the most important figures in the 18th and 19th century, who still live in our imaginations. And they had 10 days together. And so, you know, I tried to think about, like, what story would you tell your daughter, you know, first to convince her of the world, you know, and then to leave as your legacy? You know, what stories from your own life would you tell her? I could read just a tiny
yes.
Beginning where she's making this decision. There's the midwife, it's called Mrs. Blenkinsop. She calls her Mrs. B. And she's arrived when Mary Wollstonecraft is in labor and tells her, well, it's going to be a long labor and maybe you ought to tell her a story to, you know, while away the time.
So Sam, Mary, I'm going to give you the full screen here, so I'm going to disappear for a second and take it away.
Okay, thanks. So Mary Wollstonecraft says, now, daughter, I'm to tell you a story to coax you into the world. When Mrs. B says it's the darkness that binds us, I know she means nothing by it. They are words to ease my time. But the River Fleet, in the distance out my window, demands that I look. More water flowing across time, beyond pastoral fields and nursery gardens that remind me of the villages of my girlhood, out past the occasional brickworks that remind me of the worst part of my youth, my womb quickening with you. But I know that however untroubled the fleet is here in this midlife paradise, by the time it joins the Thames, it will be sullied by the bloody scraps of butcher's stalls, the bloated corpses of cats and dogs, dead flowers, and human excrement. My own story is no prettier, far from it. There are triumphs in it, a scattering of joys, but the beautiful sits side by side with the grotesque. I cannot separate them. So how could I tell you, my almost born daughter, the story of that vivid darkness as if it would persuade you of this place? Would you survive the deepest bone secrets of our brief shared being, You inside me, me inside you? No, I think not. But then true labor comes quick and hard, and at last you slip from my body. Mrs. B wraps you loosely in cotton cloth and delivers you into my arms. Your eyelids are too swollen to open, your lips unaccustomed to the ways of sucking. Your little beak searches but cannot find me. I see the worry in her eyes. She needn't say so. You're too small. Your lungs work too hard. Each breath a jagged try. But I would tell her I will not let you die. My own life force now inextricably tied to yours, 1,000 times knotted together. And though we cannot choose which day we are born, into what time or place a day chooses us. Never forget, little bird, that the day that chose you comes at the end of a month when a comet blazed across London skies, heralding your arrival. Another girl in this world. And so I will tell you the story to fill you up and bind you to this wondrous veil if you stay with us. I will tell you the moments that begin and end me, because we are made of them all, strung like pearls in time, searching always for where the new circle begins its turn, the place of our next becoming, where the line becomes an arc and curves.
That was beautiful.
Thank you.
And a beautiful reading. Oh, my gosh. I was sitting here with my Kleenex.
That was my way in to understanding what that would be. The first draft I gave my agent, my editor, was from Mary Shelley's point of view. You know, on the night she begins her Frankenstein tale and she discovers this cache of letters from her mother. And I loved it. I loved it. And my editor said, no. You know, again, forget Mary Shelley. This is Wollstonecraft's story. But so it was a way of still incorporating Shelley. And that was really useful to me to think about those 10 days, and each day Mary Wollstonecraft would tell a story from her life to her daughter. And so, you know, it makes you, when you have an entire life, it sort of forced me to choose the 10 most significant, really, plot points of her life. And when I talk about writing, I say, you know, if we had to, we could each of us pick the 10 most important plot points in our life. When we as characters were put under pressure and we had to make a choice, and that choice changed the trajectory of our lives or of who we are. And so I was able to do that with Wollstonecraft, which was very helpful to me in writing the story. And I also have to say, the very first thing I did when I started writing it was I was driving around Washington State. I dropped my daughter at film camp and had a week to just drive around the Palouse in western Washington and the old growth forests of western Washington. And I listened to Dan Stevens read Frankenstein. And I told a friend that I was listening to it, and she said, "Oh, that's the saddest story that's ever been written." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Well, really, it's about a child who's abandoned by a parent." And so, you know, we do think of the monster, Frankenstein's monster, as a monster. But really, I think in many ways, you know, Shelley was writing about the abandonment she felt in some ways by losing her mother. She was haunted by both the presence and the absence of her mother, because she considered herself, she studied her ideas and all her writings, and Mary Shelley considered herself a Wollstonecraftian. You know, and it, you know, it said that that's one of the reasons she fell in love with Percy Shelley, and they used to, you know, go and read her mother's writings out loud on her grave at St. Pancras, old St. Pancras churchyard, and that they'd make love at the graves.
I don't know.
Who knows? Who knows? You know, the mysteries of love. But I always, you know, that really changed the way I thought about Frankenstein and the way I read it. And the way I understand mother and daughter, and the importance for Shelley of losing Wollstonecraft, and the ways in which she continues to live through Shelley and for all of us.
Wow. You kind of left me speechless there. I had all these questions prepared, and now I'm like, bloop, bloop, bloop.
Well, you know, the problem is, of course, you know, as you know, that now I'm obsessed with Wollstonecraft and I have to come up with another idea for the next novel. It's like, oh, I don't know. I really don't know if I can, I'm ready to leave Mary Wollstonecraft.
You've got Dickens and Wollstonecraft in your head now as dinner guests in your brain.
So. I do. They keep me company all the time.
So let's go back to that scene, that birth scene and the stories. And I'm going to take like a way step back and say, did you use your own experience to inform that scene? And did you think about your own daughters and your own kids as you were writing from Mary's point of view to Shelley?
I have to say, three pretty marvelous experiences with birth. And I know that's not a popular thing to say.
It's okay. All birth stories are welcome here.
Okay, good. Because, you know, I did find that whenever I was pregnant that, you know, women would kind of grab me on the street and say, oh, it's going to be horrible. You know, like, just wait, get the epidural, that kind of thing. But I had sort of decided that I wanted to try hypnotherapy. And which I did, for all three births, and it worked like brilliantly every time. And so I had, they were painful labors, but they were humane and brief for the most part. And I was, giddy and energetic at the end of them. So I just count myself as being very lucky. But the enormity of it and the way it changes you is, I think that, you know, has to be the same for everyone. There's a before and after. Mm-hmm. And you can never go back. You can never go back to who you were before a baby comes out of your body. It just, you know, changes everything you understand about being human and being female, being someone who has this incredible gift. So, in fact, I still think it's kind of amazing that the patriarchy hasn't petered out when it's really women who have the, you know, all the magic power.
It's true. I always tell my daughter, I'm the one who made her. And she said, well, Daddy did too. And I said, no, he provided some ingredients, but I did the cooking. So I get credit for it.
That's great. Yeah, that's great. I love that. But certainly, you know, I did think a lot about how I could find my own voice and Wollstonecraft's voice. And part of that challenge is that, you know, she is an icon of feminism. I mean, she's this huge, again, larger than life, you know, giant, charismatic figure. How can I do her justice? And I even, you know, I went to a psychic midway. I was stuck in the middle of the novel, just full of self-doubt. I thought, I'm not the person to do this. And why did I take this on? You know, I'm not up to it. And we had such a good conversation and he immediately got how I was feeling without me telling him, because it was in my chart apparently. Yeah. So I confessed that I was writing this novel and really struggling with it. And he said, oh, well, what's her birthday? And so he basically in my session did Mary Wollstonecraft's astrological chart. And we spent the entire time talking about the confluences between our charts and, you know, the strong influences in hers that were all themes that I was already talking about in the novel, you know, without having had any idea at all. And I mean, as you know, when you're writing something, you'll take magic wherever it appears. And it was in some ways a gift that he was giving me, saying, you are the person to write this. And, you know, she wants her story to be told and she wants you to be the person who tells it. And so, you know, that was great. You know, came home, the pandemic started and I put my head down and finished the novel. But I still, you know, there's a point that comes when you do have to find your own voice and the voice of the character you're writing. Particularly someone like Wollstonecraft. And if I had to stop thinking of her as an icon and unknowable, and had to start thinking of her as a woman with probably many of the same feelings that I've had as a woman. She was a teenager. I was a teenager. She had a first sexual experience. I had a first sexual experience. She had her heart broken. So, you know, all those ways in which being a woman is still being a woman, mm-hmm. and living in the patriarchy, that those things would be similar. And so, you know, starting to think about that, what are the ways in which being a woman really has not changed since the 18th century? You know, that was where I started to find my voice and hers, and it was really useful. And that's also where my being a mother and my thinking about my own children, helped me infuse, you know, or meld with her ideas about, you know, truth and beauty and sense and sensibility, which were very, sense and sensibility were very important subjects in the 18th century. I thought Jane Austen basically invented the idea, but, you know, a century of people arguing about sense and sensibility, and Wollstonecraft was really at the forefront of that, you know, arguing for finely, keenly felt emotion that stands the test of reason. Like, you know, the joining of those two things is the right way to live. And it was, you know, it was an extraordinary idea then, and it continues to be an important idea. So starting to, you know, find my voice and think about the things I would want to tell my children. What am I really leaving behind for them? What do I want them to know? It helped me a lot. It really helped me a lot because it made me feel close to her. I mean, I found ways to feel close to Dickens, even though he was flawed and complex and difficult. And there were ways that I found to feel close to Mary Wollstonecraft, and I still feel close to her, that were really important in writing the novel.
Yeah. What was maybe one of those touch points or stories from your own life, one of the 10 that you would tell your children to leave behind in the same way Mary Wollstonecraft thought of it?
Well, plot point from my own life?
Yeah.
Well, I guess I would revisit what I spoke about before, but I'll talk about it as a plot point. So, you know, after being with my husband for 23 years and raising 3 kids, I was really surprised to find myself in love with someone else and someone who was an old friend of ours. So it was big, you know, on the surface, a really difficult thing, not just for our spouses and our children, but the community somehow felt that it was an insult to the social contract that we'd made. And, you know, I really, really struggled hard with what to do. And for a long time, and in fact, David, my partner now, we really struggled a lot over right and wrong. Like, you know, we would say, well, what if you knew 1,000 people in Iowa would die? You know, we wouldn't leave. In other words, it was a stand-in for, we don't want anyone to be harmed, but people will be harmed. And so how much harm is acceptable to us for our own happiness? And what if we choose to stay and disregard our need or, you know, our chance to be happy in this way? Maybe we're happy enough. Maybe that's as much as, you know, anyone ever gets. Maybe that's okay. And so, you know, that struggle and that decision, which affected so many people and I knew would cause pain, excruciating pain, was really difficult to make. But I was talking to a friend about it recently, and, you know, kind of revisiting the ways in which we were trying to make some ethical judgment, but we were out of our minds. You know, we were out of our minds with dopamine coursing through our brains, and, you know, reason was no match for that, really. So she said, we think we're making choices to be happy, but really we make choices to make us more who we are.
Hmm.
And that was, you know, revelatory to me that David and I were asking the wrong question at the time. What we should have been asking is, what will make us more who we are? And I think we chose well, and it did cause every bit of pain that we thought it would. And, you know, we will deal with that all of our lives together, but we are more who we are than we were before. And I think my kids know that. And I think that that's the example. That's the legacy that I want them to have for their own lives, to make choices that make their lives bigger and to make choices that make them more who they are.
Oh, look at me. If anyone is listening after the fact, I'm sitting here with my Kleenex wiping my eyes. Oh, Sam, thank you. I think that's a great note to end on. Make choices that make us more who we are.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed being with you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Whew. And thank you all for joining us. If you enjoyed the episode as much as I clearly did, please consider becoming a patron or patroness of the show to help me keep this podcast going. You can find details on donations, support, sponsorship, classes, merchandise, all of the above at writermothermonster.com. Thank you so much for being with us this evening, and have a great week.